Section 3. The case of such as are given up of God to sin, and of fallen man in general, proves moral necessity and inability to be consistent with blameworthiness. Dr. Whitby asserts freedom, not only from coaction, but necessity, to be essential to anything deserving the name of sin, and to an action being culpable. In these words, that's in the Discourse on the Five Points, edition 3, page 348, quote, "If they be thus necessitated, then neither their sins of omission or commission could deserve that name, it being essential to the nature of sin, according to St. Austin's definition, that it be an action, a quo librium es abstinere. Three things seem plainly necessary to make an action or omission culpable. Number one, that it be in our power to perform or forbear it. For, as Origen and all the fathers say, no man is blameworthy for not doing what he could not do," close quote. And elsewhere the doctor insists that, quote, "when any do evil of necessity, what they do is no vice, that they are guilty of no fault, are worthy of no blame, dispraise, or dishonor, but rather are unblameable," close quote. Well, if these things are true, in Dr. Whitby's sense of necessity, they will prove all such to be blameless who are given up of God to sin in what they commit after they are thus given up. That there is such a thing as men being judicially given up to sin is certain, if the Scripture rightly informs us, such a thing being often there spoken of, as in Psalm 81, verse 12, quote, "So I gave them up to their own heart's lust, and they walked in their own counsels," close quote. Also Acts chapter 7, verse 42, quote, "Then God turned and gave them up to worship the host of heaven," close quote. Also Romans chapter 1, verse 24, quote, "Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts to dishonor their own bodies between themselves," close quote. And also Romans chapter 1, verse 26, quote, "For this cause, God gave them up to vile affections," close quote. Also Romans chapter 1, verse 28, quote, "And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things that are not convenient," close quote. It is needless to stand particularly to inquire what God's, quote, "giving men up to their own hearts' lusts," close quote, signifies. It is sufficient to observe that hereby is certainly meant God so ordering or disposing things in some respect or other, either by doing or forbearing to do, as that the consequence should be men continuing in their sins. So much as men are given up to, so much is the consequence of their being given up, whether that be less or more. If God does not order things so, by action or permission, that sin will be the consequence. And then the event proves that they are not given up to that consequence. If good be the consequence instead of evil, then God's mercy is to be acknowledged in that good, which mercy must be contrary to God's judgment in giving up to evil. If the event must prove that they are given up to evil as the consequence, then the persons who are the subjects of this judgment must be the subjects of such an event, and so the event is necessary. If not only coaction, but all necessity, will prove men blameless, well then Judas was blameless, after Christ had given him over, and had already declared his certain damnation, and that he should verily betray him. He was guilty of no sin in betraying his master on this supposition, though his so doing is spoken of by Christ as the most aggravated sin, more heinous than the sin of Pilate in crucifying him. And the Jews in Egypt, in Jeremiah's time, were guilty of no sin in their not worshiping the true God after God had, quote, sworn by his great name that his name should be no more named in the mouth of any man of Judah in all the land of Egypt, close quote. Jeremiah 44, verse 26. Dr. Whitby, the Discourse on Five Points, page 303, denies that men in this world are ever so given up by God to sin that their wills should be necessarily determined to evil, though he owns that hereby it may become exceedingly difficult for men to do good, having a strong bent and powerful inclination to what is evil. But if we should allow the case to be just as he represents, the judgment of giving up to sin will no better agree with his notions of that liberty, which is essential to praise or blame, than if we should suppose it to render the avoiding of sin impossible. For if an impossibility of avoiding sin completely excuses a man, well, then for the same reason it's being difficult to avoid it excuses him in part, and this just in proportion to the degree of difficulty. If the influence of moral responsibility or inability be the same to excuse persons in not doing or not avoiding anything as that of natural inability, which is supposed, then undoubtedly, in like manner, mortal difficulty has the same influence to excuse with natural difficulty. But all allow that natural impossibility completely excuses, and also that natural difficulty excuses in part, and makes the act or omission less blamable in proportion to the difficulty. All natural difficulty, according to the plainest dictates of the light of nature, excuses in some degree, so that the neglect is not so blamable as if there had been no difficulty in the case. And so, the greater the difficulty is, still the more excusable, in proportion to the increase of the difficulty. And, as natural impossibility completely excuses and excludes all blame, so the nearer the difficulty approaches to impossibility, still the nearer a person is to blamelessness in proportion to that approach. And if the case of moral impossibility or necessity be just the same with natural necessity or coaction as to its influence to excuse a neglect, then also, for the same reason, the case of natural difficulty does not differ in influence to excuse a neglect from moral difficulty arising from a strong bias or bent to evil, such as Dr. Whitby owns in the case of those that are given up to their own heart's lusts. So that the fault of such persons must be lessened in proportion to the difficulty and approach to impossibility. If 10 degrees of moral difficulty make the action quite impossible, and so completely excuse, then, if there be 9 degrees of difficulty, the person is in great part excused, and is 9 degrees in 10 less blameworthy than if there had been no difficulty at all, and he has but 1 degree of blameworthiness. And the reason is plain on Arminian principles. That is to say, because as difficulty by antecedent, bent, and bias on the will is increased, liberty of indifference and self-determination in the will is diminished. So much hindrance, impediment is there in the way of the will acting freely by mere self-determination. And if 10 degrees of such hindrance take away all such liberty, then 9 degrees take away 9 parts in 10, and leave but 1 degree of liberty. And therefore, there is but 1 degree of blamableness, cateris paribus, and the neglect. The man being no further blamable in what he does or neglects, then he has liberty in that affair. For blame or praise, say they, arises wholly or completely from a good use or abuse of liberty. From all which it follows that a strong bent and bias one way and difficulty of going the contrary never causes a person to be at all more exposed to sin or anything blamable, because as the difficulty is increased, so much the less is required and expected. Though in one respect, exposedness to sin is increased, that is to say, by an increase of exposedness to the evil action or omission, yet it is diminished in another respect, to balance it, namely, as the sinfulness or blamableness of the action or omission is diminished in the same proportion, so that, on the whole, the affair as to exposedness to guilt or blame is left just as it was. To illustrate this, let us suppose a scale of a balance to be intelligent and a free agent and endued with a self-moving power by virtue of which it could act and produce effects to a certain degree. That is, to say, move itself up or down with a force equal to a weight of 10 pounds, and that it might therefore be required of it, in ordinary circumstances, to move itself down with that force, for which it has power and full liberty, and therefore would be blameworthy if it failed of it. But then, let us suppose a weight of 10 pounds to be put in the opposite scale, which in force entirely counterbalances its self-moving power, and so renders it impossible for it to move down at all, and therefore completely excuses it from any such motion. But if we suppose there to be only 9 pounds in the opposite scale, this renders its motion not impossible, but yet more difficult, so that it can now only move down with the force of 1 pound. But, however, this is all that is required of it under these circumstances. It is wholly, that's wholly, or completely, it is wholly excused from 9 parts of its motion. And if the scale, under these circumstances, neglect to move and remain at rest, all that it will be blamed for will be its neglect of that 1/10 part of its motion, for which it had as much liberty and advantage as in usual circumstances it has for the greater motion, which in such a case would be required. So that this new difficulty does not at all increase its exposedness to anything blameworthy. And thus, the very supposition of difficulty in the way of a man's duty or proclivity to sin, through a being given up to hardness of heart, or indeed by any other means whatsoever, is an inconsistence, according to Dr. Whitby's notions of liberty, virtue and vice, and blame and praise. The avoiding of sin and blame, and the doing of what is virtuous and praiseworthy, must most be always equally easy. Dr. Whitby's notions of liberty, obligation, virtue, sin, etc., led him into another great inconsistency. He abundantly insists that necessity is inconsistent with the nature of sin or fault. He says in the aforementioned treatise on page 14, who can blame a person for doing what he could not help? And on page 15, it being sensibly unjust to punish any man for doing that which was never in his power to avoid. And on page 341, to confirm his opinion, he quotes one of the fathers, saying, "Why doth God command, if man hath not free will and power to obey?" And again, in the same and the next page, who will not cry out that it is folly to command him that hath not liberty to do what is commanded, and that it is unjust to condemn him, that it has it not in his power to do what is required? And, on page 373, he cites another saying, a law is given to him that can turn to both parts, i.e., obey or transgress it. But no law can be against him who is bound by nature. And yet, the same Dr. Whitby asserts that fallen man is not able to perform perfect obedience. On page 165, he has these words, quote, the nature of Adam had power to continue innocent and without sin, whereas it is certain our nature never had, close quote. But if we have not power to continue innocent and without sin, then sin is not inconsistent with necessity, and we may be sinful in that which we have not power to avoid. And those things cannot be true, which he asserts elsewhere, namely, quote, that if we be necessitated, neither sins of omission nor commission would deserve that name, close quote, page 248. If we have it not in our power to be innocent, then we have it not in our power to be blameless. And if so, we are under a necessity of being blameworthy. And how does this consist with what he so often asserts, that necessity is inconsistent with blame or praise? If we have it not in our power to perform perfect obedience to all the commands of God, then we are under a necessity of breaking some commands in some degree, having no power to perform so much as is commanded. And if so, why does he cry out of the unreasonableness and folly of commanding beyond what men have power to do? Arminians in general are very inconsistent with themselves in what they say of the inability of fallen man in this respect. They strenuously maintain that it would be unjust in God to require anything of us beyond our present power and ability to perform, and also hold that we are now unable to perform perfect obedience, and that Christ died to satisfy for the imperfections of our obedience, and has made way that our imperfect obedience might be accepted instead of perfect, wherein they seem insensibly to run themselves into the grossest inconsistency. For, as I have observed elsewhere, quote, they hold that God, in mercy to mankind, has abolished that rigorous constitution or law that they were under originally, and instead of it has introduced a more mild constitution, and put us under a new law, which requires no more than imperfect, sincere obedience in compliance with our poor, infirm, impotent circumstances since the fall. Close quote. Edwards isn't laughing here, I am. Now, how can these things be made consistent? I would ask, of what law are these imperfections of our obedience a breach? If they are a breach of no law that we were ever under, then they are not sins. And if they be not sins, what need of Christ dying to satisfy for them? But if they are sins, and the breach of some law, what law is it? They cannot be a breach of their new law, for that requires no other than imperfect obedience, or obedience with imperfections. And therefore, to have obedience attended with imperfections is no breach of it, for it is as much as it requires. And they cannot be a breach of their old law, for that, they say, is entirely abolished, and we were never under it. They say it would not be just in God to require of us perfect obedience, because it would not be just to require more than we could perform, or to punish us for failing of it. And therefore, by their own scheme, the imperfections of our obedience do not deserve to be punished. What need, therefore, of Christ dying to satisfy for them? What need of his suffering to satisfy for that which is no fault, and in its own nature deserves no suffering? What need of Christ dying to purchase that our imperfect obedience should be accepted, when according to their scheme, it would be unjust in itself that any other obedience than imperfect should be required? What need of Christ dying to make way for God's accepting of such obedience, as it would be unjust in him not to accept? Is there any need of Christ dying to prevail with God not to do unrighteously? If it be said that Christ died to satisfy that old law for us, that so we might not be under it, but that there might be room for our being under a more mild law, still, I would inquire, what need of Christ dying that we might not be under a law, which by their principles, it would be in itself unjust that we should be under, whether Christ had died or not, because in our present state we are not able to keep it? So, the Arminians are inconsistent with themselves, not only in what they say of the need of Christ's satisfaction to atone for those imperfections which we cannot avoid, but also in what they say of the grace of God, granted to enable men to perform the sincere obedience of the new law. Quote, "I grant indeed," says Dr. Stebbing, "that by original sin, we are utterly disabled for the performance of the condition without new grace from God. But I say then that he gives such a grace to all of us by which the performance of the condition is truly possible. And upon this ground, he may and doth most righteously require it." Close quote. Well, if Dr. Stebbing intends to speak properly, by grace, he must mean that assistance which is of grace, or free favor and kindness. But yet, in the same place, he speaks of it as very unreasonable unjust and cruel for God to require that as the condition of pardon, that it is become impossible by original sin. Well, if it be so, what grace is there in giving assistance and ability to perform the condition of pardon? Or why is that called by the name of grace? That is an absolute debt, which God is bound to bestow, and which it would be unjust and cruel in him to withhold, seeing he that requires that as the condition of pardon, which he cannot perform without it. Section 4. Command and obligation to obedience, consistent with moral inability to obey. It being so much insisted on by Arminian writers that necessity is inconsistent with law or command, and particularly that it is absurd to suppose God, by his command, should require that of men which they are unable to do, not allowing in this case for any difference between natural and moral inability. I would therefore now particularly consider this matter, and for greater clearness, I would distinctly lay down the following things. Roman numeral number 1. The will itself, and not only those actions which are the effects of the will, is the proper object of precept or command. That is, such a state or acts of men's wills are in many cases properly required of them by commands. And not only those alterations in the state of their bodies or minds that are the consequences of volition. This is most manifest, for it is the soul only that is properly and directly the subject of precepts or commands, that only being capable of receiving or perceiving commands. The motions or state of the body are matter of command, only as they are subject to the soul and connected with its actions. But now, the soul has no other faculty whereby it can, in the most direct and proper sense, consent, yield to, or comply with any command, but the faculty of the will. And it is by this faculty only that the soul can directly disobey or refuse compliance. For the very notions of consenting, yielding, accepting, complying, refusing, rejecting, etc. are, according to the means of the terms, nothing but certain acts of the will. Obedience, in the primary nature of it, is the submitting and yielding of the will of one to the will of another. Disobedience is the not consenting, not complying of the will of the commanded to the manifested will of the commander. Other actions that are not actions of the will, such as certain motions of the body and alterations in the soul, are obedience or disobedience only indirectly, as they are connected with the state or actions of the will, according to an established law of nature. So, that it is manifest, the will itself may be required, and the being of a good will is the most proper, direct, and immediate subject of command. And if this cannot be prescribed or required by command or precept, nothing can. For other things can be required no otherwise than as they depend upon and are the fruits of a good will. Corollary number 1. If there be several acts of the will, or a series of acts, one following another, and one the effect of another, the first and determining act is properly the subject of command. And not only the consequent acts, which are dependent upon it. Yea, this more especially is that to which command or precept has a proper respect, because it is this act that determines the whole affair. In this act, the obedience or disobedience lies in a peculiar manner, the consequent actions being all governed and determined by it. This governing act must be the proper object of precept or none. Corollary number two. It also follows from what has been observed that if there be any act or exertion of the soul prior to all three acts of choice in the case, directing and determining what the acts of the will shall be, that act of the soul cannot properly be subject to any command or precept in any respect whatsoever, either directly or indirectly, immediately or remotely. Such acts cannot be subject to commands directly because they are no acts of the will, being, by the supposition, prior to all acts of the will, determining and giving rise to all its actions. They not being acts of the will, there can be in them no consent to or compliance with any command. Neither can they be subject to command or precept indirectly or remotely. For they are not so much as the effects or consequences of the will being prior to all its actions. So, that if there be any obedience in that original action of the soul, determining all volitions, it is an act of obedience, wherein the will has no concern at all, it preceding every act of will. And therefore, if the soul either obeys or disobeys in this act, it is completely involuntary. There is no willing obedience or rebellion, no compliance or opposition of the will in the affair. And what sort of obedience or rebellion is this? And thus, the Arminian notion of the freedom of the will, consisting in the soul's determining its own act of will, instead of being essential to moral agency, and to men being the subjects of moral government, is utterly inconsistent with it. For if the soul determines all its acts of will, it is therein subject to no command or moral government, as has been now observed. Because its original determining action is no action of will or choice, it being prior, by the supposition, to every act of will. And the soul cannot be the subject of command in the act of the will itself, which depends on the foregoing determining act, and is determined by it, inasmuch as this is necessary, being the necessary consequence and effect of that prior determining act, which is not voluntary. Nor can the man be the subject of command or government in his external actions, because these are all necessary, being the necessary effects of the acts of the will themselves. So that mankind, according to this scheme, are subjects of command or moral government in nothing at all. And all their moral agency is entirely excluded, and no room is left for virtue or vice in the world. So that the Arminian scheme, and not that of the Calvinists, is utterly inconsistent with moral government, and with all use of laws, precepts, prohibitions, promisings, or threatenings. Neither is there any way whatsoever to make their principles consist with these things. For if it be said that there is no prior determining act of the soul preceding the acts of the will, but that volitions are events that come to pass by pure accident, without any determining cause, this is most palpably inconsistent with all use of laws and precepts. For nothing is more plain than that laws can be of no use to direct and regulate perfect accident, which, by the supposition of its being pure accident, is in no case regulated by anything preceding, but happens this way or that, perfectly by chance, without any cause or rule. The perfect uselessness of laws and precepts also follows from the Arminian notion of indifference as essential to that liberty, which is requisite to virtue or vice. For the end of laws is to bind to one side, and the end of commands is to turn the will one way, and therefore they are of no use unless they turn or bias the will that way. But if liberty consists in indifference, then they're biasing the will one way only destroys liberty, as it puts the will out of equilibrium, so that the will, having a bias, through the influence of binding law laid upon it, is not completely left to itself to determine itself which way it will without influence from without. Roman numeral number 2. Having shown that the will itself, especially in those acts which are original, leading and determining in any case, is the proper subject of precept and command, and not only those alterations in the body, etc., which are the effects of the will, I now proceed, in the second place, to observe that the very opposition or defect of the will itself in its original and determining act in the case to a thing proposed or commanded, or its failing of compliance, implies a moral inability to that thing. Or, in other words, whenever a command requires a certain state or action of the will, and the person commanded, notwithstanding the command and the circumstances under which it is exhibited, still finds his will opposite or lacking, wanting, in that belonging to its state or acts, which is original and determining in the affair, that man is morally unable to obey that command. This is manifest from what was observed in the first part concerning the nature of moral inability, as distinguished from natural, where it was observed that a man may then be said to be morally unable to do a thing when he is under the influence or prevalence of a contrary inclination, or has a lack of inclination under such circumstances and views. And it is also evident from what has been before proved that the will is always, and in every individual act, necessarily determined by the strongest motive, and so is always unable to go against the motive, which, all things considered, has now the greatest strength and advantage to move the will. But, not further to insist on these things, the truth of the position now laid down, that is to say, that when the will is opposite to, or failing of a compliance with, a thing, in its original determination or action, it is not able to comply, it appears by the consideration of these two things. Number one, the will, in the time of that diverse or opposite leading act or inclination, and when actually under its influence, is not able to exert itself to the contrary, to make an alteration in order to a compliance. The inclination is unable to change itself, and that for this plain reason, that it is unable to incline to change itself. Present choice cannot at present choose to be otherwise, for that would be at present to choose something diverse from what is at present chosen. If the will, all things now considered, inclines or chooses to go that way, then it cannot choose, all things now considered, to go the other way, and so cannot choose to be made to go the other way. To suppose that the mind is now sincerely inclined to change itself to a different inclination is to suppose the mind is now truly inclined otherwise than it is now inclined. The will may oppose some future remote act that it is exposed to, but not its own present act. Number two, as it is impossible that the will should comply with the thing commanded with respect to its leading act, or by any act of its own, in the time of that diverse or opposite leading and original act, or after it has actually come under the influence of that determining choice or inclination, so it is impossible it should be determined to a compliance by any foregoing act. For, by the very supposition, there is no foregoing act. The opposite or non-complying act being that act which is original and determining in the case. Therefore, it must be so that if this first determining act be found non-complying on the proposal of the command, the mind is morally unable to obey. For to suppose it to be able to obey is to suppose it to be able to determine and cause its first determining act to be otherwise, and that it has power better to govern and regulate its first governing and regulating act, which is absurd. For it is to suppose a prior act of the will determining its first determining act, that is, an act prior to the first, and leading and governing the original and governing act of all, which is a contradiction. Here, if it should be said that although the mind has not any ability to will contrary to what it does will in the original and leading act of the will, because there's no supposed to be no prior act to determine and order it otherwise, and the will cannot immediately change itself, because it cannot at present incline to a change, yet the mind has an ability for the present to forbear to proceed to action, and taking time for deliberation, which may be an occasion of the change of the inclination. Well, I answer first. In this objection, that seems to be forgotten, which was observed before, that is to say, that the determining to take the matter into consideration is itself an act of the will, and if this be all the act wherein the mind exercises ability and freedom, then this, by the supposition, must be all that can be commanded or required by precept. And if this act be the commanding act, then all that has been observed concerning the commanding act of the will remains true, that the very lack of it is a moral inability to exert it, etc. Secondly, we are speaking concerning the first and leading act of the will about the affair, and if determining to deliberate, or on the contrary, to proceed immediately without deliberating, be the first and leading act, or whether it be or not, if there be another act before it which determines that, or whatever be the original and leading act, still the foregoing proof stands good, that the non-compliance of the leading act implies moral inability to comply. If it should be objected that these things make all moral inability equal, and suppose men morally unable to will otherwise than they actually do will in all cases, and equally so in every instance, in answer to this objection, I desire two things may be observed. First, that if by being equally unable be meant as really unable, then, so far as the inability is merely mortal, it is true. The will, in every instance, acts by moral necessity, and is morally unable to act otherwise, as truly and properly in one case as another, as I humbly conceive, has been perfectly and abundantly demonstrated by what has been said in the preceding part of this essay. But yet, in some respect, the inability may be said to be greater in some instances than others, though the man may be truly unable, if moral inability can truly be called inability, yet he may be further from being able to do some things than others, as it is in things which men are naturally unable to do, like fly. A person whose strength is no more than sufficient to lift the weight of 100 pounds is as truly and really unable to lift 101 pounds as 10,000 pounds, but yet he is further from being able to lift the latter weight than the former, and so, according to the common use of speech, has a greater inability for it. So it is in moral inability. A man is truly, morally unable to choose contrary to a present inclination, which in the least degree prevails, or contrary to that motive, which, all things considered, has strength and advantage now to move the will, in the least degree, superior to all other motives in view. But yet, he is further from ability to resist a very strong habit, and a violent and deeply rooted inclination, or a motive vastly exceeding all others in strength. And again, the inability may, in some respects, be called greater in some instances than others, as it may be more general and extensive to all acts of that kind. And so men may be said to be unable in a different sense, and to be further from moral ability, who have that moral inability, which is general and habitual, than they who have only that inability which is occasional and particular. Thus, in cases of natural inability, he that is born blind may be said to be unable to see in a different manner, and is, in some respects, further from being able to see than he whose sight is hindered by a transient cloud or mist. And besides, that which was observed in the first part of this discourse concerning the inability which attends a strong and settled habit, there should be remembered. That is to say, that a fixed habit is attended with this peculiar moral inability, by which it is distinguished from occasional volition, namely, that endeavors to avoid future volitions of that kind, which are agreeable to such a habit, much more frequently and commonly proving vain and insufficient. For though it is impossible there should be any sincere endeavors against the present choice, yet there may be against volitions of that kind, when viewed at a distance. A person may desire and use means to prevent future exercises of a certain inclination, like lust or something, and, in order to do it, may wish the habit might be removed, but his desires and endeavors may be ineffectual. The man may be said, in some sense, to be unable, yea, even as the word unable is a relative term and has relation to ineffectual endeavors, yet not with regard to present, but rather remote endeavors. Secondly, it must be borne in mind, according to what was observed before, that indeed, no inability whatsoever, which is merely moral, is properly called by the name of inability, and that is the strictest propriety of speech. A man may be said to have a thing in his power if he has it at his election, and he cannot be said to be unable to do a thing when he can, if he now pleases, or whenever he has a proper, direct, and immediate desire for it. As to those desires and endeavors that may be against the exercises of a strong habit, with regard to which men may be said to be unable to avoid these exercises, they are remote desires and endeavors in two respects. First, as to time. They are never against present volitions, but only against volitions of such a kind, when viewed at a distance. And secondly, as to their nature, these opposite desires are not directly and properly against the habit and inclination itself, or the volitions in which it is exercised. For these, in themselves considered, are agreeable. But against something else that attends them, or is their consequence, the opposition of the mind is leveled entirely against this. The volitions themselves are not at all opposed directly and for their own sake, but rather only indirectly and remotely on the account of something foreign. Roman numeral number 3. Though the opposition of the will itself, or the very lack of will to a thing commanded, implies a moral inability to that thing, yet, if it be, as has been already shown, that the being of a good state or act of will is a thing most properly required by command, then, in some cases, such a state or act of will may properly be required, which at present is not, and which may also be wanting or lacking after it is commanded. And therefore, those things may properly be commanded, for which men have a moral inability. Such a state or act of the will may be required by command, as does not already exist. For if that volition only may be commanded to be, which already is, there could be no use of precept. Commands in all cases would be perfectly vain and impertinent. And not only may such a will be required as is wanting before the command is given, but also such as may possibly be wanting afterwards, such as the exhibition of the command may not be effectual to produce or excite. Otherwise, no such thing as disobedience to a proper and rightful command is possible in any case, and there is no case possible wherein there can be a faulty disobedience, which Arminians cannot affirm consistently with their principle. For this makes obedience to just and proper commands always necessary, and disobedience impossible. And so, the Arminian would overthrow himself, yielding the very point we are upon, which he so strenuously denies, that is to say, that law and command are consistent with necessity. If merely that inability will excuse disobedience, which is implied in the opposition or defect of inclination, remaining after the command is exhibited, then wickedness always carries that in it which excuses it. By how much the more wickedness there is in a man's heart, by so much is his inclination to evil the stronger, and by so much the more. Therefore, has he a moral inability to the good required? His moral inability, consisting in the strength of his evil inclination, is the very thing wherein his wickedness consists. And yet, according to Arminian principles, it must be a thing inconsistent with wickedness. And by how much the more he has of it, by so much he is or is he the further from wickedness. Therefore, on the whole, it is manifest that moral inability alone, which consists in disinclination, never renders anything improperly the subject matter of precept or command, and never can excuse any person in disobedience or lack of conformity to a command. Natural inability arising from the lack of natural capacity or external hindrance, which alone is properly called inability, without doubt, completely excuses or makes a thing improperly the matter of command. If men are excused from doing or acting any good thing, supposed to be commanded, it must be through some defect or obstacle that is not in the will itself, but either in the capacity of understanding or body or outward circumstances. Here are two or three things that may be observed. Number one, as to spiritual acts, or any good thing in the state or immanent acts of the will itself, or of the affections, which are only certain modes of the exercise of the will. If persons are justly excused, it must be through lack of capacity in the natural faculty of understanding. Thus the same spiritual duties or holy affections and exercises of heart cannot be required of men as may be of angels, the capacity of understanding being so much inferior. So, men cannot be required to love those amiable persons whom they have had no opportunity to see or hear of or know in any way agreeable to the natural state and capacity of the human understanding. But the insufficiency of motives will not excuse, unless their being insufficient arises not from the moral state of the will or inclination itself, but rather from the state of the natural understanding. The great kindness and generosity of another may be a motive insufficient to excite gratitude in the person that receives the kindness through his vile and ungrateful temper. In this case, the insufficiency of the motive arises from the state of the will or inclination of heart and does not at all excuse. But if this generosity is not sufficient to excite gratitude, being unknown, there being no means of information adequate to the state and measure of the person's faculties, this insufficiency is attended with a natural inability, which entirely excuses it. Number two, as to such motions of body, or exercises and alterations of mind, which do not consist in the immanent acts or state of the will itself, but are supposed to be required as effects of the will, in cases wherein there is no lack of a capacity of understanding, that inability, and that only, excuses, which consists in lack of connection between them and the will. If the will fully complies, and the proposed effect does not approve, or does not prove, according to the laws of nature, to be connected with his volition, the man is perfectly excused. He has a natural inability to the thing required. For the will itself, as has been observed, is all that can be directly and immediately required by command, and other things only indirectly, as connected with the will. If, therefore, there be a full compliance of will, the person has done his duty. And if other things do not prove to be connected with his volition, that is not criminally owing to him. Number three. Both these kinds of natural inability and all inability that excuses may be resolved into one thing, namely, one of natural capacity or strength, either capacity of understanding or external strength. For when there are external defects and obstacles, they would be no obstacles were it not for the imperfection and limitations of understanding and strength. Corollary. If things for which men have a moral inability may properly be the matter of precept or command, then they may also have invitation and counsel. Commands and invitations come very much to the same thing. The difference is only circumstantial. Commands are as much a manifestation of the will of him that speaks as invitations, and as much testimonies of expectation of compliance. The difference between them lies in nothing that touches the affair at hand. The main difference between command and invitation consists in the enforcement of the will of him who commands or invites. In the latter, it is his kindness, the goodness from which his will arises. In the former, it is his authority. But whatever be the ground of will in him that speaks, or the enforcement of what he says, yet, seeing neither his will nor his expectation is any more testified in the one case than the other, therefore, a person being directed by invitation is no more an evidence of sincerity in him that directs, and manifesting either a will or expectation which he has not, than a person being known to be morally unable to do what he has directed by command is an evidence of insincerity. So that all this grand objection of Arminians against the inability of fallen men to exert faith in Christ or to perform other spiritual duties from the sincerity of God's counsels and invitations must be without force.